This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, and I've got something kind of special for you today. I know I say that every week, but this series of podcast interviews have generally been with entertainers I've had the pleasure of working with, but I ran across this guy by listening to a friend of mine's podcast. He's a professional stand-up comic, mostly works the East Coast, and we haven't had a chance to work together, but a terrific guy. He is the king of corporate comedy, kind of a business humorist. You've seen him on Comedy Central. He's clean, he's fun, and he's from Chicago. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show, Greg Schwemm. Wow, Greg. The crowd's going crazy. It's that Chicago thing. They love those people.
That's right. I have never had applause for a podcast intro, so I appreciate that.
Well, you know, the crowd goes nuts, and when they hear there's a professional entertainer of your stature joining the show, the crowd gets extra excited.
I'm sure they do.
Chance to learn a little bit about you from my friend Carl's podcast. And mm-hmm. I wanted to follow up on that and dig a little deeper into the stand-up comedy that you've been performing over the years. But let's kind of introduce the audience to Greg. I know that you and I swam in the same waters back in the 90s. I was running a club, and actually three clubs at the time, and working with a lot of the great West Coast entertainers and a few from the East. How did you kind of fall into stand-up comedy?
Yeah, well, it started as a hobby for me really before the comedy boom. I mean, I first got on stage in 1978. I was 16.
Oh, I didn't know
that's
that.
Way back.
So yeah, before the big wave.
It really was. And so I did some stand-up in high school. I did some stand-up at college around the dorms and so forth, where I went to Northwestern University, which a lot of really great comedians came out of Northwestern. Not necessarily within my time, but Stephen Colbert was from Northwestern. Seth Meyers is from Northwestern. They were either just before or just after me. But Northwestern had a reputation as being, you know, kind of a hotbed of entertainment. And so I did it around there. And then I moved to Florida to be a journalist. I just always thought stand-up would be a hobby. But that is when the boom was in full swing, and in that mid-80s time frame, and comedy clubs were popping up everywhere. And I didn't know anybody in Florida, so I started going to clubs just to have something to do and get on. And I got stage time, and then they opened up. And maybe, I don't know if you remember this, again, being on the West Coast, but there was a AA club in West Palm Beach, Florida, called the Comedy Corner.
Oh,
and
yeah.
It was open. Yeah, it was opened by a guy named John Stoll, and John was a big-time concert promoter who happened to love stand-up. It was just, he just loved comedians. And because he had very deep pockets, he was able to open this club and bring in some of the top acts. These are acts that were just like starting to play theaters. And again, we're talking guys like Seinfeld, like Bill Maher, you know, that were taking advantage, that were on the forefront of the comedy boom. These guys would come down on a regular basis, and I lived 10 minutes from that club, and I used to just be able to go and just walk in anytime, stand in the back and see the best in action. And the more I saw them, the more I was thinking, I can do this. You know, you learn from the best. And I quit my job and eventually decided to do stand up full time. And I was living in Florida, so I was working the clubs in the Southeast, but I knew I had to get out of Florida.
Yeah.
No offense to Florida. offense to Florida, but you know where I'm coming from there. You want to be in a big city.
Right. And you got a chance to see, those were all guys that worked for me. Bill Maher and Seinfeld were regulars at my club back in the day. I opened Laughs in 1980, so we saw a lot of the same people. And I've often said, in fact, it's in my book, 20 Questions Answered About Being a Stand-Up Comic, available on Amazon, that it is important to watch other entertainers. Yeah, yeah, I'm quick.
That was really, you just slid that right in there. I love it.
But it's true that a lot of the people that want to get into the entertainment business, any kind of entertainment, but especially comedy, it is advantageous to watch others, especially seasoned pros, doing their stuff because you can learn so much. Do you, were you doing open mics, actually doing sets? Do you remember any of your first bits or jokes?
Oh, gosh, yes. I actually, though, yes, I was doing open mics, and I, you know, I learned very early to customize. And living in South Florida, living in West Palm Beach, there was a lot going on down there. There still is. I mean, South Florida is just a hot mess and always has been. So, but one of my bits that I did was I did a bit called South Florida Jeopardy. And it was as if Jeopardy took place in the Miami, Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach area. And, you know, I had my categories, somewhat politically incorrect. I mean, probably couldn't get away with that now, but it was like, you know, famous Cubans,
What was your favorite transportation mode to get from Cuba? Yeah.
What's that? I can't even remember what that. I don't even think I had a question for that. It was the name of the category that got the laugh. But then I had a couple of questions, and people just went nuts. And I learned, and this helped me later on in terms of what I'm doing now. I learned to very early to at least a portion. You should try and write material for your audience if you can, and that is a principle that has continued to. That I've continued to try and respect as I continue to move through comedy.
Yeah,
and
you've been
get into the corporate world.
You've been extremely successful in the corporate world, and one of the secrets to being a corporate entertainer is writing for the audience and engaging with the audience and adding material or names that recognize them. Much like what you were doing with Jeopardy in Florida, is that by bringing something to the audience that they all have heard of and all can relate to, you're bringing them in quickly into your comedy world. And then your humorous take on Jeopardy is what brings the laughter. Now, those first few years, it's difficult normally to get stage time. There was the comedy boom. There were clubs opening. In fact, one of the comedy teams, Mac and Jamie, came out of South Florida, who are good friends of mine, were saying that they would often drive up to New York and do that drive just to catch more rooms, like Catch a Rising Star and the Improv.
Sure.
Were you finding enough places to work in Florida? Were you doing a little transportation to hit clubs?
Yeah, there was plenty of places to work in Florida. I mean, there was a chain called Coconuts.
Which had
like 13 rooms.
Okay? Oh, I didn't know they had that many. Yeah, I remember
they
Coconuts.
They had them all over the place. Right. But the more I worked these clubs and the more it would have been very easy to never leave Florida. And I know comics that did it, that just continued to work those rooms twice a year and a few others and so forth. And you could do that. But I knew right along, it's like if you just work Florida, you're going to get a very Florida act. And I knew I didn't want that. I knew I had to get out and see what people outside of Florida. Just like comics who, you know, there are comics who never leave New York and they kill in New York. But, you know, a joke about eating a slice on the stoop and listening to the Yankees game, you know, that might not fly in Kansas. And, you know what I'm saying? And I think it's just, that's why I think working the road is so important and was such a great school. So, you know, for me, moving to Chicago was kind of the best of all worlds. They had about 20 clubs between the city and the suburbs. So if I wanted to stay home, I could still work. It was also, it wasn't New York, it wasn't LA, so the competition wasn't as fierce. And we talked a little bit beforehand, before we got on air here, and you mentioned, did I ever get out to the West Coast? And when I was working the club scene? The answer was no, because I knew at that time I could not compete. I needed stage time, and I knew I wasn't going to get it out there in LA, nor was I ready for it. So, and I kind of felt the same way about New York. I mean, you were really hitting with the big boys, and I thought it would be better to just be in a big city, and be able to work a big city, but also, you know, again, be in the Midwest, very centrally located, lots of clubs within, say, an 8-hour drive.
Right,
so
right.
And I worked Ohio and, you know, and Kentucky and, you know, those play and, you know, Wisconsin and a lot of those play. And that was kind of my whole base.
Well, what you do is you end up becoming a bigger fish in a little bit smaller pond. I mean, Chicago is a huge entertainment base, but I've often said in other interviews, it's come up that you could become a big fish, even in the Bay Area, San Francisco. And then when you go down to LA, you're starting over, you're showcasing, you have to reprove yourself because the amount of competition is so much stiffer. And I could totally see how that would be the same in New York. You had people like Mark Schiff and Seinfeld and Larry Miller coming out of New York. Mm-hmm. And there was some really strong presence in those clubs. But I think that, were you working the Castle and a lot of those places in Chicago area?
I love it, Michigan, like Mark Ridley's room. I did not work that. I worked the chains, like I worked the Funny Bone chain. I worked several clubs there. I tried not to, though. One thing I tried not to do is I tried not to put all my eggs in one basket. That was like the coconuts thing. I didn't want to. It would have been nice to call the Funny Bone and get 30 weeks. And a lot of comics did that. And of course, you're like, oh my gosh, okay, my calendar is now filled. I can see this much money's coming in. It was sort of a breather, but I didn't want to do that for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think if you put all your eggs in one basket and then you have a bad show or get a bad report, there goes the basket, you know? And I saw that happen to comics too. And all of a sudden you're not the catch of the day anymore. I never wanted to get complacent. And I think it would have been very easy to get complacent if one phone call could have netted you 35 weeks.
Right. Right.
I would rather hustle.
Yeah. Yeah. And it also, doesn't allow you when you're forcing yourself to work different rooms, which basically means different audiences. It forces you to stay on your toes, material wise and presentation wise. You don't want to get too complacent. Stand-up comedy, or pretty much any entertainment, much like other areas of, you know, being a lawyer or doctor, whatever, if you want to be the best, if you want to grow as a entertainer, you have to challenge yourself over and over and over again. And it was much like what you alluded to with the Florida situation. If you only wrote material for Florida, you would have trouble performing that in Chicago. You have to branch mm-hmm. out and force yourself to write to different audiences. And I think that whether you knew it or not, you made a really good choice. Now, you were on the road for several years. Do you have any really good or bad stories that kind of make you laugh?
Make me laugh? That I haven't repressed through years of therapy? I mean, there's a lot of good ones. There's some late, I mean, there's, you know, there, you can always go back with the cringeworthy comedy condos and, you know, what was awaiting you when you showed up. I mean, that was the one thing about being on the road. I always likened it to it. I said, imagine every week you're meeting your new college roommate, you know, in a new dorm. That's kind of what being on the road was like. And you never quite knew who it was going to be. Until you opened that door. And then, of course, you had to live with her for a full week. And I mean, some of those relationships were great and some I couldn't wait to get out of there. We all have, you know, there's obviously lots of, you know, stories of going up against, I don't know if I, you know, absolutely my absolute worst encounter was a one-nighter in Pensacola, Florida for a military group who had just gotten back from the Gulf War. And it was, I mean, literally had gotten back like the day before and we're ready to party. And that party did not include listening to me for 45 minutes.
Yeah, so, that might be challenging. They want to get let loose and go crazy,
exactly.
Not sit politely as an audience.
Shut up. Wow. We have rules, you know, Sergeant. They don't want to hear that. And if I was them, I wouldn't have wanted to listen to me either. But, again, it's all a learning process. And there's nothing, I was never in fear for my life, that's for sure. I've never had one of those. And I know comics, I still think, the late Bill Hicks, just his, he, if you can see it on YouTube, it's a one-on-one interview with Kevin Matthews, who was a big Chicago DJ. And he talked about his worst gig, and it was just the two of them. There was no live audience. And he was talking about something in the South. Why is it, Scott, that everybody's worst gig always takes place in the South?
That's true, actually.
There's no don't get me started on Spokane. nobody starts their hell gig story. It's always Alabama, Mississippi. It's always one of those states. And
Bill Hicks was a hard hitting guy, and you could see. I thought he was hilarious. He worked for me several times, but he definitely had an edge to him, and you could see
not for everybody.
Right. Yeah. He's not for everybody. Yeah. And you could take offense at some of the ways he presents things, but that's what made him Bill Hicks. I mean, he was a character. Right. He had developed a character. He was actually a really nice guy off stage, but on stage he was acidic to the point that if you weren't going with the flow, if you didn't go with the Bill Hicks way of entertainment, you could get upset by it. But that's a great example of somebody that really took stand-up comedy to a different area, took a different path and had some great success with it. It was sad when we lost him, though.
It was. The funniest part of that story, just take a second. I'm not going to tell the whole story, but he tells the whole story of this awful, awful gig. But the kicker, he says, so on the second night, he tells this awful story, but he has to go back.
Right.
Go back and perform again. And that's when it just totally, it's so relatable to comics is like, even you still have a job to do. So if you're there for, a 4-night engagement and the first night is the worst thing you've ever encountered, you still have you can't quit. You still have to go back.
Yeah, the show
and do
must
three
go
more
on.
Night.
Yeah, the show must go on.
Including the late show.
Right. And it's so funny that you mentioned that because I can remember many, many shows that I produced where things went awry, either a bad audience or a comic had a bad set or just it was sometimes a bad comic. But you had to find a way around it. Now, I was the producer, not an entertainer. I had an easy solution. If somebody was really pissing off an audience or not funny, I fired them. In my history, there was only two acts that I fired midweek, Bill Kirkenbauer and Bill Maher. That were not doing relating or caring. And that was a bigger thing to me. If you're not having a good set, that's one thing. But if you disrespect and don't care about the audience that paid to see you, that as a producer threw me. Now, this brings up a good second question for you. Who have you worked with, that might be that the audience may have heard of that really might have influenced you or maybe mentored you? Was there any of the name acts that you got a chance to hang with that maybe affected your comedy career?
Yeah, definitely. Larry Miller, I think he's one. You mentioned him briefly as some of the comics that came out of New York, and a lot of people might not know him off the top. Larry Miller, probably best known as the suck-up salesman in Pretty Woman, which was a career-making role for him. Give him the tie. Who ordered the pizza? Yeah, that was Larry Miller to a T. And it's weird. It's funny because this place, the Comedy Corner, when they would let some of the locals perform with some of the biggest names. And when they said to me, Greg, you're going to get a chance to perform with Larry Miller, I was really disappointed because I'd never heard of him. and at the time. And somebody was like, oh, no, he's good. And I'm like, who is Larry Miller? And then the first night that I watched this guy, I was like, this guy is an absolute technician. And just the way he approaches his craft. And I ended up working with him several times. Once, I think, back at the corner. And I think I then worked with him in Chicago at the Funny Firm a couple of years later. And, you know, he remembered me. And I actually asked him, you know, what he thought of my set, which I know a lot of comics don't like to do. They probably are nice, but he took the time to watch it and really gave me some pointers. But just, again, I learned a lot from just the way he approached every show. And that has stuck with me. So I would say him more than anything. And I've also learned from comics about what they won't do. I worked with Dennis Miller years ago I opened for him at the Erie Crown Theater. And he watched my set, which I had heard he normally would not do. But he watched. This is when he was at the height of this was Monday Night Football, Dennis Miller. So he sold out 4,000 people at the Erie Crown Theater. And he watched my set and I came off stage. And he's like, yeah, he says that. And I had a really good set. And he says, I get the impression you do a lot of corporate gigs. And I go, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. And he goes, yeah, he says, they won't let me, I don't do those anymore because they won't let me say fuck. And at first I was like, wow, how much money are you turning down for that? That was my first thought. But then I thought, this is a guy who just, that's part of his act. And it's like nobody, he stuck to his guts. You know, he's like, nobody's going to tell me how to do my performance. And that kind of stuck with me too. Now, I don't think I've ever been in a situation. I'm not that famous where I probably have that kind of leverage or say, look, this is the way I do my set, take it or leave it. But I did find it interesting that he admitted that.
Yeah, and Dennis Miller is a unique, he's much like Bill Hicks. He created his own path. He had a different way of doing things. Some people felt he sold out a little bit when he did Monday Night Football, but he, you know, with the Dennis Miller Show and everything he's done on TV and on stage, he is certainly another unique personality that's had a lot of success. It's a funny quick story. Dennis worked for me quite a bit back in the day, and I was shooting craps in Tahoe one night really late. It was like 2-3 in the morning, and I hear my name yelled out from across the casino, and here comes Dennis Miller, and he had like a showroom babe on each arm, and he's yelling my name and waving, and he comes over, and I actually, you know, had to stop the roll, which pissed off the table. And I'm like, hey, Dennis, how's it going? Good to see you. And as soon as he got to me, he goes, yeah, hey, good to see you. He turns and walks away. It wasn't anything to do with, you know, our relationship and saying hi. He wanted everybody in the casino to see him walking through with these two models on his arms.
Interesting. And yeah,
it was such a Dennis Miller move, you know. But, you know, it was a funny moment for me, and it's a great story to share. But it sounds like also I wanted to go back just a little bit. A lot of my regular listeners will have known this, but I've worked with hundreds, if not thousands, of entertainers, and I could not pick my favorite. But if I was forced under threat, Larry Miller has always been my top choice. He was a terrific friend. We spent a lot of time together. Amazing stories, amazing act, his drinking story, his skiing story. Oh. And yes. I've often explained how a lot of comics do jokes or a bit that might last a minute or two, but Larry was able to do like a 15-minute story bit and keep everybody laughing and enthralled through the whole thing. He was incredible. So I think that you having time with Larry and people like that helped you develop as a corporate entertainer. Now, why don't you explain to the audience, because they've heard a lot of stand-up club acts, how did you transition to corporate comedy? Because that's a whole nother beast.
Oh, it is. It is. And well, what really did it was in the mid-90s, I started doing a lot of material about computers in my nightclub act, okay, in my comedy club act. Because at the time, if you remember, and about Windows 95 was really when all of a sudden everybody had to learn how to use a computer, and with it, the internet. But really, first they had to learn how to use a computer. And it was just sort of all of a sudden this technology was just thrust upon everybody. And we didn't really, no one told us how to do it. It was just like, here it is, figure it out. And this was true. Right? And this was true in your office and in your at home too. And I mean, if we all remember those of us who you know, had to learn how to use a computer, you know, we didn't grow up learning how to use it. We just suddenly had to learn. We all remember things like the Microsoft paperclip and the are you sure you want to delete that? And that kind of, and the tech support calls, where you would just call and be on hold for hours for just the dumbest questions. I mean, they don't even have that anymore. And I would do these bits, and the audience, they would so resonate. I remember once I worked with Jackie Mason. Remember? Okay, passed away within the last year. And he was back doing nightclubs, and he watched me, and he's like, "Oh my god!" He says, "That computer stuff you do." He says, He says, "This look at this audience." He goes, "This audience is like very old. They're my audience, but they still." He says, "I don't understand how they are loving that stuff." And I go, "Because everybody, it doesn't matter how old you are, is having to figure this out." And he's like, "Well, I guess that's true, you know." So because of doing that, I would have people come up to me after shows and say, can you come down to our office? We're having a Christmas party. We're having this, we're having an offsite meeting. And just if you do those bits, you've just described totally, you know, it's that whole thing about you should come to my office if you want to see what's funny. But it wasn't like they weren't telling me that their office was funny. They were like, you have just nailed it. So yeah, we're not going to tell you.
You're being super relatable. Yeah,
exactly. You do that. So I started getting invites to do these things, and then little by little I got a couple of corporate agents interested in me just through word of mouth, and they started booking me for bigger events. And honestly, Scott, again, I went from journalism to comedy. I never worked in an office. I never had a corporate job. As a result, I had no idea that corporate events existed. I just didn't know that they had these 3-day offsite meetings at the, you know, at the Peabody in Orlando or at these swanky resorts. That was a whole new world for me. And once I started doing these and doing well at them, and again, figuring out, we go back to the customization thing, figuring out that people love to laugh at themselves. They love to laugh at their work and what they did. And if you could do that I figured out very quickly, they love to laugh at themselves as long as you don't piss them off. Like this is why so many comics cannot do corporate events, because they make that mistake. They make that mistake of crossing the line.
Yeah, one too far.
Instead of making them laugh, you're belittling them or you're mocking what they do for a living. And yet that's death. That is you will never get the audience back. And I was lucky that I kind of figured that out. And the more I did them, I mean, again, the pay was way better. The accommodations were sure as hell better. The time of day. I mean, I was, when I got into this, I had my first child, and I knew this whole thing of continuing to work clubs where you were working until midnight on every Saturday or being gone. I'm like, I don't know if I want to continue down this path. So, I mean, cause clubs after a while, they all look alike, you know, and you start, I think you start to question, no offense, you owned clubs, but I think you start to question if you're in comedy clubs for too long, where am I going with this?
Right. It should be a stepping stone. It doesn't have to be the end all, you know,
exactly.
Comedy clubs of my ilk. I was in A Room. It was the step before TV. It was a step before a sitcom or getting a writing gig on a TV show or something like that. And there, it should have been a tool to get you to something that would be, it, you know, take your career farther. Now, that I love road comics that stayed on the road their whole career as a producer. That was really valuable to me because you knew what you were getting, and the audience was always going to be entertained. But I also took a lot of pride in the fact that people that started off with me as an opening act MC and ended up on TV or having a great career, you know, that's impressive. Going corporate, and it sounds like you kind of accidentally fell into it, found that it was a niche that you were good at. And again, by incorporating the company that you were entertaining into the show. So, you know, you throw out a couple things with the boss's name. You know, if it's a CPA convention, you have a couple CPA jokes and the computer stuff. What a great entry point, because even today, 20 years later, whatever, everybody can relate to the issues that we all have with computers and copiers and any sort of electronic machine. So I think what a great gift, Greg, you were able to develop and make that not only who you are, the business humorist, but be able to make a career. Because like you said, you're staying in better places. The pay is way better. The crowds are more polite. And you can still have a family life.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I rarely ever work, and this, to this day, most corporate events are midweek. They're like in the Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday range. I rarely worked weekends. And it was kind of the best of all worlds. And, you know, that really continues to this day. So, I mean, I you know, here's the other thing. The other thing, Scott, is that I knew also, we go back to work in clubs and is there a future in this? But when I started doing it full time, the boom had crested. You know, it was not on the way up. If anything, it was kind of on the way down. So I kind of got into it at you know, the high end, you know, it's sort of like in real estate, you know, buy low, sell high. Well, I kind of bought high. All right.
Yeah, you got into comedy at the crest of the wave.
Yes, exactly. And I knew there were so many guys in there that I thought, okay, I got to do something to separate myself from the pack. And doing corporates was really a way to do that. Because again, it's like, how long can you continue to be a club comic, or how long can you continue to be a feature act? And if your goal is just to headline, that's great, but you're still headlining clubs week after week. Well, and eventually, how far is that going to get?
Well, Greg, one of the things that I think the audience needs to understand, and I as a producer totally appreciate, is that one of the biggest challenges for entertainers, stand-up comics, going from club work to corporate work, is that many of them cannot work clean. Yep. And, you know, Steve Bruner's a good friend of mine. He's a great corporate comic. He's always been clean. There's just a few. There's not a ton. Tim Bedore's another. There's Greg Otto. There's a few of them that were clean, went into corporate, and made a good career out of it. But, Greg, you've had such success in corporate work. Was it difficult for you? I get the sense that you never really worked dirty, but was it, how big a change going from comedy clubs to corporate? Was it an adjustment for you?
It was. I mean, yeah, you're right. I'd never, if I worked dirty or if I was profane, I never would have gotten the chance to do corporates. You know, that's kind of a, there's no negotiation there. And with your clients, but even still there were, you know, I remember once I did a joke about in a corporate date, it was in Hawaii. It was one of the very first corporate dates I did. And probably the one, still one of the, it's like, you know, I went out to this resort in Hawaii and I'm like, I am so not ready for this, you know? And it was about 400. They were a Mormon based food service company.
Wow.
Which maybe there's probably a joke in there somewhere, but
in Hawaii,
you know, and they, right. And there was this big event. And, I remember I did a joke about circumcision, and I can't remember the joke, but it was one of those, taboo buzzwords where they just heard that word and that's, and they tuned out the rest. You know, you've seen that. It's like where you want to say, look, you know, and then they came up to me and they were just all up in arms. And because I was so new at this, I felt like I wasn't ready to defend myself. You know, I would do that. I would say, look, did you really listen to the whole joke or did you stop after you heard that word? Because if you listen to the whole joke, you will see that whatever what you're telling me was so offensive probably isn't. And I have had that conversation with certain clients and eventually they've come around and said, okay, maybe we did overreact, but I wasn't in a position to do that. But my manager at the time, he said to me, he's like, you know, Greg, he says, what you have to do is just go through your act. And he says, if you even think there's something that in your mind might raise a red flag with somebody, he goes, it's just not worth it. He goes, take it out. It's not worth it.
And there's ways to find different words to say the same thing.
Yeah, there is. And I still do that to this day. Now it's getting harder and harder because, you know, we could spend a whole nother podcast on talking about what is and isn't offensive to people. But
well, everything is today.
Still,
but yeah.
Exactly. And that's what, that's what's sad a little bit about, corporate comedy, but comedy in general is everybody wants to laugh, providing you do it on their terms.
Yeah. And it makes
and
it
those
difficult.
Terms are getting more and more vague depending on who you're talking to.
Well, and I think they're getting a little crazy now to tone, but let me use that as a way to pivot the conversation because that's the next word I wanted to bring up is pivot. Mm-hmm. When the COVID came along and clubs basically shut down, corporations had to cancel all their gigs, were you able to pivot and provide your entertainment and some of your motivational talks to corporations after that? Were you able to do it online?
Virtually, I was. Did I like it? No.
Yeah, I mean, there's no feeling with the audience. There's no response.
No,
there's
none,
no energy.
None. And yeah, and I think that, you know, I think virtual entertainment and virtual speakers just sort of followed the path of virtual meetings, meaning it was kind of cute and fun at first, and it quickly became like, I don't know how much longer I can get up every morning and stare at a bunch of boxes and then log off and do another one 15 minutes later, you know? So I did it. I did my best. I felt like when you're doing virtual comedy, I feel like the audience, you're getting sympathy laughs. Like they're almost feeling sorry for you. Like this is every bit as weird for us as it is for him.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Now I had a couple good ones. Like I did a couple of Christmas parties and I could tell the audience was kind of liquored up virtually, which I mean, obviously when you're doing live shows, I'm okay with them drinking, but not hammered, you know?
Right.
And virtually it's like, hey, drink as much as you want.
I really don't care.
If you get into it with the virtual, you're not going to virtually heckle me, first of all. And if you do, the technology itself, it's just going to be the two of us talking over one another. So it's not worth it. But to see people, you know, maybe with their Santa hat on and raising their glass, that was kind of fun. But for most of them, it was just, you try and you make fun of their virtual backgrounds and so forth, but your hands are somewhat tied. And comedy is, you know, a lot of motivational, a lot of corporate speakers could do the exact same speech virtually as they do live. And I've met speakers that liked that liked not traveling. They like being home. I'm not that guy and never will be. I need to see people in front of me. I need to hear them. I need to know that they're enjoying it. And I need to know that they're not going to suddenly slide their lens closed, you know?
Right, right.
Well, in the middle of my show.
And I think that's a key difference between a motivational speaker and a comic is that in comedy, one of the things that I think makes it special is you form a bond with the audience. There's a shared energy. There's a communion of we're all in this together for the next, you know, 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and let's
absolutely
have some fun. When it's a motivational talk that's coming over a Zoom call, you might pick up something. There might be something there that would benefit you, but you're not sharing the same air. You're not experiencing the same thing. And I imagine, and it sounds like it was a bit challenging, but now we're getting to the other side of it. As we come out of this, are you starting to pick up more corporate gigs going into late 22 and into 23?
Very much so. Yeah. And I'm cautiously optimistic because I feel like we've been down this road before. I mean, I feel like in spring of 2021, we had that kind of same attitude, like this is over. And I had a, you know, I had a really good fall and it was all in-person stuff.
Awesome.
And it was like, this is what I remember. And it is just such a pleasure. And was the audience socially distanced? Yes. And were they wearing masks? Yes. I didn't care. I was with them and they were getting to see me live and I thought, great. And then of course Omicron hit and everybody pulled back again. And Christmas was so incredibly depressing for me because I was like, I'm sure most people in show business were like this too. Like, I don't know how much longer I can keep doing this. I don't know how much longer I can keep going back again and starting over. And that's kind of what I felt that was happening. And, you know, once again, companies were pushing their meetings back or postponing them or canceling them altogether. And it's like, we've already done this twice. And now, again, we're seeing, like you said, we're kind of coming out of that. And I am getting, the phone is ringing, the emails lighten up a lot more. I am booking a lot more. And the interesting thing, and I feel like COVID will really benefit people who make people laugh for a living, because I think it's a true statement to say we need to laugh now. We need, you know, that we need to lighten up. I felt the same way after, you know, like 9/11. 9/11 was a great example of you could just say to companies, look, do you have to be, we've been sad long enough. We've been,
we've been locked up long enough.
Yes, we've been locked up long enough. We've been isolated. We need to reconnect with each other, and humor is a great way to do that.
Exactly.
I think so. For all these, I've been very bold with companies. I've looked at their agendas, and they're like, "Well, you know, it sounds fun, but I don't know if we have room." And I've actually said, "Let's you and I look at your schedule. Let's look at you and I look at your agenda. You have, you know, a diversity speaker, and then you have another diversity speaker, and then
exactly.
It's like you're repeating yourself three times. Why can't you squeeze in 30 minutes of fun? Because I don't see any fun on your agenda. I don't see anything.
You're just beating everybody over the head with, you know,
yes.
Sad that it's going that way. Well, yeah. I think Greg Schwemm, as the king of corporate comedy, is the answer. So everybody out there in podcast land, if you have a meeting coming up or a special event and you want somebody who's clean, who's funny, who's professional, give Greg a call. You can find him on the Googler, and there is always going to be some entertainment for your company or your group. Greg, it's been really terrific getting to know you and hearing your story. I think that it is a unique one in the sense that even though a lot of stand-up comics follow a similar wide path, it has been mentioned a couple times in this podcast, people take different avenues, take different roads to their success, and to create yourself into or mold yourself into a successful corporate entertainer was smart. I think you've had some great success. Congratulations. I think that you've really had a terrific career.
Thank you. I appreciate it, Scott. And I'm sorry I didn't get to know you earlier when you were running your clubs, because I heard so much about those clubs, except that they were on the West Coast. But I would love it if you still opened your clubs and we got to know each other now, and if you still had them, I would love to come out and work them. Even if I didn't headline, even if I'd be fine featuring, just a chance to get out and work the West Coast club scene.
Well,
just
I'm still
I can say I've done it.
Yeah, I'm still booking some corporate events, so mostly charity fundraisers. So I will keep your number, and hopefully we'll get a chance to work together. But ladies and gentlemen of my special podcast, you don't have to wait for that. I have pilfered some of Greg's material, and I'm going to share a little bit right now with the audience. Greg, thanks so much for doing the podcast. Everybody out there, if you get a chance and you're looking for a terrific corporate comedian, motivational speaker, the business humorist, Greg Schwemm is your guy. And Greg, anything else you want to share with the audience?
No, I think you pretty much did it. Just everybody get out there and support live comedy. Stop watching it on your phone. Go see comedians. Seriously, go see comedians live, okay? Because we've waited a long time. We've waited a long time to do what we love.
I totally agree, and that is a great message to end on. Thank you so much, Greg. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Greg Schwemm. And right now, and stay tuned and listen to some great stand-up comedy by Greg Schwemm. Here he is. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you.
At a meeting like this, when you're surrounded by your compatriots, I think the worst thing that can happen to you is to be seen using a payphone. Because people kind of walk by and look at you like, oh yeah, you're a player. Hey, whip out your typewriter. Let's do a little business here, huh? We can't just talk on the phone anymore. Now we got to do stuff on the phone. Now, I was in a coffee store one day, and I see this kid, and he's typing into the phone. And I'm a comedian. I'm curious. I walk over and go, what are you doing? He goes, well, I'm sending a wireless text message to my girlfriend. Yes, you see, I just type the message in, then I hit send. She gets it on her phone. Pretty cool, huh? Yeah. Of course, you can always call her since you're holding a phone! Use the phone! Now, that's like driving to New York and pulling your jet behind the car, you know? If meetings were that important, we'd have meetings in our personal lives. Wouldn't that be weird if your whole life was a structure around a meeting? If your secretary followed you around 24 hours a day, mine would be waking me up on Saturday morning. Mr. Schwemm, get out of bed. You have a very busy day. Let's look at your schedule. Let's see. Looks like you got an 8:30 a.m. with your wife in the kitchen. She'll be discussing the current state of the lawn. Then you're giving a speech to your three-year-old at noon. You'll be speaking on the art of peeing in the toilet, not around it. You got a four-hour cocktail party with yourself in front of the football game between 2 and 6. Yeah. You're meeting the Domino's guy for dinner at 7, and tentatively you got a 10:30 p.m. with your wife in the bedroom. I'm thinking that's going to be canceled. What do you think, sir? Well, that FIPS token is specifically defined by Citrix as a token that is in compliance with FIPS. So basically, all I know about this group is that you stopped using complete words years ago. Is that right? Yeah. What is a typical day for the folks at USS? I'll put it in your language. I figure what? You probably get up in the AM after a night of R&R, take off your PJs, drink some OJ, get to work ASAP, right? All day long, you sit at your PCs dreaming of BS and trying to figure out how you can improve your shrinking DPMs, right? And maybe in 20 years, you'll make VP. You go home in the PM, what do you do? Well, you stop at an ATM, you punch your PIN, you grab a C-note. You go home, your kids say, what's for dinner? You say, if I hear one more FAQ, your kids are going to be SOL. They got to eat, right? So what do? You hop in your BMW or SUV, you drive to KFC, get them a little dinner. They come home, they eat dinner, you sit around your BVDs, drink an MGD, and watch an HBO, CNN, MTV, and VH1 before taping ER on your VCR, catching some Z's. That's your life. Is that right, folks?
That was Greg Schwemm. If you get a chance and you want to good, clean corporate guy, give him a call. He's easy to find on the internet. And being Chicago-based, he's kind of central. They can go East Coast, West Coast. And it was a great pleasure to get a chance to learn more about his life and stand-up comedy on this podcast. We hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Thanks for listening. Be sure to share, and we'll see you next week. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand-Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.